We're going to talk about Judaism confronting Hellenism. Alexander the Great dies in 323 BCE, at which point in time the entire East was swept by a wave of wars by successors who fought over the inheritance. Josephus discusses this in Book 12, Chapter 1, in his work Antiquities of the Jews. He mentions Antigonus, who obtained Asia, Seleucus, Babylon, Lysimachus governed Hellespont, Cassander possessed Macedonia, Ptolemy seized Egypt. So you have a whole bunch of generals who are fighting amongst each other to take over for Alexander the Great. And by the year 301 BCE, finally, Ptolemy the First of Egypt is in control of Eretz Yisrael. And Josephus writes that he seized upon Jerusalem and for that end made use of deceit and treachery. For as he came into the sea on a Sabbath day, as he would offer a sacrifice, he without any trouble gained the city. So he basically told the inhabitants of Yerushalayim that he's simply offering a korban. And for that end made use of deceit and treachery, as I mentioned. And I'm sorry, while the Jews did not oppose him. The Jews didn't oppose him because he said, I'm going to offer a korban. For they did not suspect him to be their enemy. And he gated thus because they were free from suspicion of him. And because on that day they were at rest and quietness. It was Shabbos, so they weren't going to fight him on Shabbos. And when he gained it, he ruled over it in a cruel manner. So Ptolemy the First controls Eretz Yisrael. You had the Ptolemies on the who controlled Egypt. You had the Seleucids who controlled Syria. And Eretz Yisrael is in the middle. So again, from 301 BCE, Ptolemy is in control of Eretz Yisrael. And he's cruel to the Jews. Now, the Palestine or Eretz Yisrael was very close, as I mentioned, to the Seleucid heartland, and it was an important strategic base for the defense of Egypt, and its economic worth was no less than its military value. So it was very important for the Ptolemies, for those from Egypt, to control Eretz Yisrael. And they controlled it from 301 BCE until about 200 BCE. Just to put in perspective, the Hanukkah story happens about 164 BCE. So again, the second base of Medius is built around 516 BCE. In the 400s BCE, that's when you have Ezra and Nehemiah. And you have Alexander the Great conquers Eretz Yisrael 332 BCE. And then from about 301 until about 200, the Ptolemies are controlling Eretz Yisrael. Antiochus III, this was not Antiochus of Hanukkah. This is Antiochus III. He's ruling from 223 to 187 BCE. He conquers most of the country. He's defeated in 217 BCE by Ptolemy IV and lost all that he had won. But in the year 200 BCE, he wins a decisive victory. And as a result, control of Eretz Yisrael passes from the Ptolemies to the Seleucids. And essentially, the Jews helped him. According to Josephus, the Jews gave his army plenty of provisions. They assisted him, and he was grateful to them. And he actually writes to the governor of Syria, and he says the following, quote, since the Jews upon our first entrance on their country demonstrated their friendship towards us, and when we came to their city, received us in a splendid manner and came to meet us with their senate, and gave abundance of provisions to our soldiers and to the elephants, and joined with us in ejecting the garrison of the Egyptians. So Antiochus III says that the Jews helped his army against the Egyptians. So as a result, he writes that he is going to give them as pension for their sacrifices of animals that are fit for sacrifice, for wine and oil and frankincense, the value of 20,000 pieces of silver. He gives them a lot of materials for korbanos, for sacrifices. He gives them flour. He gives them salt. And besides that, he also writes that, and let all of that nation live according to the laws of their own country. So he's going to let them follow their halacha. and let the Senate and the priests and the scribes of the temple and the sacred singers be discharged from poll money and the crown tax, so the Kohanim and the Levim don't have to pay taxes. And that the city may sooner recover the inhabitants, its inhabitants, I grant a discharge from taxes for 3 years to its present inhabitants. He basically says you don't have to pay taxes for 3 years. And he also, so he writes, we also discharge them for the future from a third part of their taxes. Again, he cuts their taxes by a third. The Jews help Antiochus III conquer Yerushalayim. And he is very favorable. He immediately restores to the Jews the rights of living under their laws. He cuts their taxes, and he's very good to the Jews. So then you have the Jews now being controlled by the Seleucid Empire starting from 200 or 201 BCE. Now, when the Greeks control Eretz Yisrael, they bring about demographic changes. They don't, starting from when Alexander the Great conquers Eretz Yisrael and during the reign of the Ptolemies and the reign of the Seleucids, the Jews are not exiled for the most part. Although it should be pointed out that Josephus does write that Ptolemy did exile a lot of Jews to Egypt, and that's from there we find a large Hellenized Jewish community in Egypt. But we don't find that all the Jews are exiled from Yerushalayim and there's a population exchange. Rather, Greek military colonies are founded in Eretz Yisrael, and the influence of the Hellenistic cities set its imprint on the country's life. Now, it's important to understand that even before the Seleucids controlled Eretz Yisrael, even when the Ptolemies ruled over Eretz Yisrael in the 3rd century BCE, the Jews confronted Hellenism. And this was finally a culture which was a significant culture that the Jews had to confront. Prior to the Greeks and Hellenism confronting Judaism, any other type of culture was viewed by the Jews as inferior, and there was no concern that that was going to influence the Jews. But with Hellenism, this became a significant challenge to the Jews. And one thing that happened, as an example, is that during this time period, during the middle of the 3rd century, during the reign of the Hellenist king Ptolemy Philadelphus, the Torah was translated into Greek in what became known as the Septuagint. And this story is recorded in the Gemara and Megillah Daf Tes Amud Aleph, going on to Amud Beis, where there's a brisa which says, Masei b'Talmai HaMelech Shekinei Shivim U'Shnayim Zekenim. There's a story of Talmai HaMelech, Ptolemy, who gathered 72 elders, V'chnisam b'Shivim U'Shnayim Batim. He gathered them into 72 houses. V'lo gila lahem amakim. So he didn't tell them why he gathered them into these houses. V'nichad etzel kol echad v'echad v'omer lahem. And he brought, he went to every house and he said to them, Kisvili Torah Moshe Rabchem, write for me the Torah, translation of the Torah of Moshe. Nosan Kadosh Baruch Hu B'lev Kol Echad V'Echad Eitzav Yiskimu Kulon Das Achas. And all of these 72 elders, they all made certain changes, and God performed a miracle that they all made the same changes. Now the question is, was this viewed as a good thing or a bad thing, the translation of the Torah into Greek? Now, in the Gemara, in Megillah, we find that there's a quote from Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel who says that the only translation which was permitted for the Torah was Greek. And Rabbi Abbo said the name of Rabbi Yochanan, the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. And Rabbi Yochanan explained what was the reason why Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said that you could have a translation of the Torah into Greek based on the pasuk from Parshas Noach, Yaftil Okim Liyafes, V'yishkon Baalei Shem, where the Torah says that Hashem should enlarge Yafes and he should dwell in the tents of shame. They, of course, were children of Noach. Devarav Shel Yafes, Yu Baalei Shem. This indicates that the words of Yafes should be in the tents of shame. And the language of Yavan who is the forebearer of the Greek nation, he's one of the descendants of Yefes, will serve as a sacred language in the tents of shame. So this, I guess, line in the Gemara seems to put a positive spin on the translation of the Torah into Greek. That being said, there are also statements by Chazal which seem to place a negative spin on the translation of the Torah into Greek. In Maseches Sofrim, for example, in Perek Aleph Halacha Zayin, so there we actually find that Maaseh B'Chamishas came Shekatzu Talmi HaMelech as a Torah Yevadis, that it wasn't that the Ptolemy first asked the Jews to translate into Greek, but actually five elders wrote to Ptolemy and translated into Greek, V'haya oso hayom kasha li Yisrael k'yom shenaseh bo egel. And this day was so difficult for the Jewish people, like the day when the golden calf was made. Why is that? What's the problem with translating the Torah into Greek? And according to the Maseches Sofrim, shelo haisa Torah yechola lihitargem kol tzarka. And the reason is that the translation could not be done accurately, because every single word of the Torah has multiple meanings. For example, the Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us, Achas diber Elokim shtaim zushamati. Hashem said one thing and I heard two things. And the Gemara says, Mikra echad yotzi l'kama tamim, that one passage of the Torah can have several meanings. And Devei Rabbi Shmuel, the Beis Medrash Rabbi Shmuel teaches, Ucha patish butzei tziyat sela, ma patish ze mischalek l'kama nitzos, zap mikra echad yotzi l'kama tamim. He writes that based on the pasuk in Yirmiyahu, he says that my word is like fire and like a hammer that shatters rock, just as the hammer produces several sparks, so too one passage of the Torah produces several meanings. So by translating the Torah into a foreign language, you are limiting the multiple meanings of the Torah, and therefore it's kiyom shenaseh bo ha'egel, according to Maseches Sofrim. Also, Megillas Tanis writes, and this is cited in the Shulchan Aruch, Arachayim, Siman Tafkuf Pei, Seif Beis, that on the 8th of Teves, when the Torah was written into Greek, and they have told me, Hayachoshech ba'olam shlosh yamim, there was darkness in the world for 3 days. And some people have the custom to fast on the 8th day of Teves for this very reason. Interestingly enough, as was mentioned, and there was a miracle according to the Gemara, that the sages who translated the Torah into Greek, they made a number of changes because they didn't want to give off a false impression to the Greeks. So just as an example, in the Torah, we know the Torah says that when Hashem decides to create man, he says, Nasa Adam b'tzalmeinu v'chid b'tzalmeinu, let us make man in our image. So God consults the angels. And of course, it can give off the impression that there are multiple deities. Why is God asking someone else, another being, consulting, should he make in mankind? God decides himself. So we know the Rashi quotes Chazal that this shows God's humility. He's trying to teach us the importance of humility, that Hashem is consulting the angels. However, to tell the Greeks that God consulted another being and decided to create man, so this feeds into their mistaken notion of polytheism. And therefore, when each of the 72 elders translated the Torah, they translated this pasuk as Vayomer Elokim Esa Adam Betzalem Uvidmus, that God himself said, I will make man in my image and my form. So he didn't say Nasa Adam Betzalmenu, so that the Greeks don't use this to prove the false notion of polytheism. In any case, this was a challenge about translating the Torah into Greek so that the masses perhaps could read the Torah, even the Jews, but then you have the non-Jews with the ability to read and translate the Torah and perhaps to not only translate it incorrectly without the full meaning of the Torah, of the words of the Torah, but also perhaps to also provide corrupted meanings as well that are against, you know, basic beliefs in the Torah. We know that many people translate or explain the Torah nowadays in ways that go against basic Jewish principles, basic Jewish ideologies and beliefs. And that's a challenge to making the Torah accessible to the masses. So this was a challenge that Hellenism brought to the Jewish people, the translation of the Torah, the translation of Tanakh. Now, who had the power at this time? So we know from the beginning of Pirkei Avos that the Mesorah went from Moshe to Yehoshua to the Zakenim. The Zakenim are the elders. They lived at the time of the Shoftim. And then after the Zakenim, you had the spiritual leaders being the Nevi'im, the prophets. They were around during the time of the first base of Mikdash and the destruction of the first base of Mikdash, and maybe the very beginning of the second base of Mikdash. And then after them came the Anshik and Esagdol, the men of the great assembly. And the second mission of Pirkei Avos tells us that Shimon HaTzadik was Mishyorei Knesses HaGdola. He was at the end of the Anshik Knesses HaGdola. And it seems that after him, a new type of leadership arose, the Sanhedrin. And Sanhedrin comes from the Greek word synhedrion, of sitting together. And again, when does this take place? So probably at the end of the 3rd century BCE, probably. It makes sense, probably, because after Shimon HaTzadik, the next leader was Antignos, and after Antignos, there was Yose ben Yoezer and Yose ben Yochanan, and that's in Mishnah Gimel and Dalet. And Yose ben Yoezer was persecuted by the Hellenists. So probably Shimon HaTzadik is probably around 200 or so BCE. And he changes everything in terms of the leadership. He was the end of the Anshik Knesses HaGdola. What was this change from the Anshik Knesses HaGdola to the Sanhedrin? So some scholars argue that the membership in the Anshik Knesses HaGdola was based on lineage and yichus, and the membership was entirely upper class. Now the lower class didn't care. However, once the upper class began to imitate the ways of the Greeks, the scholars from the lower class were concerned that Jewish tradition would be swept aside by Hellenization. And Shimon HaTzadik, who was Mishyorei Knesses HaGdola, the very end of the Anshik Knesses HaGdola, recognized this problem. He was very concerned about the upper class being swept into Hellenization, and therefore he replaced the Anshik Knesses HaGdola with this new type of leadership called the Sanhedrin, which would include in its membership both lower class scribes together with upper class elders. And starting from 191 BCE, the Kohen Gadol was no longer the head of this group, but the Nasi was the head. It's not so clear exactly when the Sanhedrin was created, but it's important to know that around now, the religious leadership is now in the hands of not only members of the upper class, but members of the lower class as well. And in the beginning of this is taking place in the beginning of the Seleucid rule. And Antiochus III, when he conquered most of the country, it didn't really change the pattern of the administration and the habits of the Jews who were living in Judea. And again, as I mentioned, that the population was exempted from all taxation for 3 years, and afterwards they were granted a reduction of a third in its taxes, and the leadership, the members of the Sanhedrin, and the Kohanim were given complete exemption from taxes, and there was good relations with Antiochus and the Jews, Antiochus III and the Jews, and also with Antiochus III's son and the Jews. Antiochus III's son, Seleucus IV, who ruled from 187 to 175 BCE, things were good. However, eventually the situation changed, because Antiochus III, when he was defeated by the Romans in 188 BCE, and he signed a peace treaty which placed a very heavy financial burden on the Seleucid kingdom to pay the victorious Roman Republic, so from that point on, the kings of the Seleucid dynasty found themselves compelled to raise money from every source. And in those days, they didn't have banks. But much of the money and the wealth was found in some of the temples throughout the kingdom, including the Beis Hamikdash in Yerushalayim. And Seleucus, Antiochus' son, attempted to appropriate money from the treasury of the Mikdash in Yerushalayim. And again, his goal was not to offend the Jewish religion. He simply acted out of basic financial considerations. However, this was the first stage in the clash between the Jews and the Seleucid Kingdom, a clash which ended up resulting in the battle and many battles, which led to the miracle and the holiday, which we call Chanukah, to be discussed, God willing, next week.